We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. And they are both just fresh in from the 8K run for the viaduct.
I'm a little winded, but okay. I'm glad that the viaduct did not collapse while I was on it.
Yes. Yeah.
And I did not run the 8K. To say.
Okay. Uh-huh.
I did, but it was only to provide comic relief for everybody else there.
All right. So plenty to cover, starting with local. And I think most people, if you live in Seattle, you got a ballot this week.
Yes, there is a special election on February 12th. That is, ballots are due a week from Tuesday for the school district. They need an operating and capital levy for a lot of money they're asking for. It'll be a 17% property tax increase. It's kind of an odd ask because the state legislature in its compromise over McCleary only allows about, I believe, an 8% property tax increase for local districts. And so the school district in Seattle is making a calculating political choice. By trying to put pressure on the state legislature to increase the amount that local school districts can ask for. Now, the school district certainly needs this kind of money. It's been chronically short-shifted and short-funded both by the feds and by the state government for well over a decade. And, of course, the district itself has experienced explosive growth over the last 5 years with the growth of population in Seattle and the growth of families with small children moving into Seattle. Schools are bursting at the seams in a lot of Seattle. And so the capital levy is also asking for a lot of money and for basically tear downs and remodels for 8 different schools. The concerns about this school levy, aside from the large price tag, have to do with the school district leadership and what they're actually asking for and whether they can be trusted to deliver on it. The district leadership, are they asking for money for charter schools? Are they asking for money for privatization of education? It's really hard to tell from the information that the district has given out about the levy and what it would pay for in terms of its operating levy. This comes on the heels. Last year, the voters passed a levy for the city and for its role in auxiliary programs for education. So the voters are being asked to approve yet more money for the district. And there's naturally, I think, going to be some resistance to that, particularly because of the price tag and the fact that many voters in Seattle, particularly in property taxpayers, have already been pretty heavily taxed, and it's one of the factors that's causing people to move out of Seattle if they can't afford rents or they can't afford the property taxes on their modest dwellings. So I think there's going to be some resistance on that front and some resistance on the front of the district leadership because they've really burned through any residual goodwill they might have had with the numerous problems that the district has. I think that folks should vote yes on this simply because the money's got to come from somewhere and the district at this point does need the money, but they also need to be watchdogged very carefully to make sure that the promises that they're making with these levies are actually honored and that the money is being spent for what voters think that it's supposed to be spent for.
Yeah, I think the district has said that if they don't get the operations levy passed, that they will have to lay off over 1,000 different staff members throughout the district.
Yeah, and that what is likely if it doesn't pass is that they're going to come back to voters with another levy and another levy. This has happened in the past. I think in the 90s at one point it took 4 different votes for the district mm-hmm. to get its levy passed. And they'll just keep coming to the voters with revised levies until it does pass. So I don't think the layoffs are going to happen, but it's certainly an indicator of the seriousness of the shortfall in funding that the district has. And to its credit, it's been saying for about 1.5, 2 years that they're seriously short-funded and that they need additional money and that they're likely to face a crisis in funding because of the growth of the district and its enrollments.
Yeah.
All right.
So yes on the ballot, and get your ballot in by February 12th.
All right. Also this week, Mayor Jenny Durkan's, or a potential response, at least from council members, to manager Mayor Jenny Durkan's choice for the Human Services Director.
Yeah, Jason Johnson, who's been serving as interim director since last spring, is Mayor Durkan's choice, which means, of course, that Johnson's overseen an increase in homeless encampment sweeps, an expansion of the controversial navigation team, and implementation of the mayor's data-driven plan to address homelessness, which involves cutting off funding to several homeless service groups that she doesn't like. For example, Share Wheel, and primarily, it appears, because they allow self-governance by homeless people in their encampments, something that is very much against what her initiatives are for providing services to the homeless population, initiatives that rely very heavily on a top-down approach.
And to be fair, that's a continuation of the city's approach over the last 10 years or so. It's very paternalistic. It assumes that homelessness is a result of bad individual choices that need to be, cured.
Managed the way a parent and, manages
yeah,
a child.
And, of course, homeless people themselves have no seat at the table in any of the policies that are decided. And, obviously homeless organizations and homeless service providers have long complained about this approach. And the proof is in the data. The increase in homelessness is a systemic problem. It's a problem with the increasing rents over the last several years in Seattle, which have a direct correlation to the amount of homeless people on the streets, not surprisingly. But, because the city is run by developers, they can't really acknowledge that. And so it's a problem of individual choices. And Johnson very much reflects and is an enthusiastic advocate for that approach. It's pretty problematic.
Now, needless to say, those human services providers and homeless services providers complained to the city council. And along with several employees of the Human Services Department, they testified in an evening forum that was held by council member Shama Sawant. The union steward for employees of the Human Services Department said this week that employees of the department are circulating a petition to the mayor asking her to retract Johnson's nomination and conduct a more transparent selection process, as she, or actually her deputy mayor, had promised. At least 130 employees had signed the document as of last week. And the Human Services Coalition, a group of social service providers that help people of color, seniors, and the disabled, sent a letter to council members asking them to reject the nomination of Johnson and to ask the mayor to conduct a thorough search process that also involves the stakeholders, nonprofits that provide services to folks in the community, homelessness service providers, people who have experienced or are experiencing homelessness, and also people who use the other services of the Human Services Department would be termed stakeholders. Now, remember, Council Member Shama Sawant is the chair of the Human Services Equitable Development and Renters Rights Committee. She's been very committed to her committee work throughout her council term. Now, her committee would be tasked with taking up Johnson's nomination, holding a hearing on it, and voting to advance the nomination to the entire council. But this week, Sawant responded to all of the feedback from human service providers and employees of the department by drafting a resolution to delay the consideration of Johnson's nomination until a formal search process can be completed, and to request that the mayor set up a search committee that includes all of the stakeholders. And she said that she plans to introduce that resolution to the council on Monday. In addition, council members Teresa Mosqueda and Lorena Gonzalez had sent a letter to Mayor Durkan requesting that she conduct a search process for a new director, similar to the ones conducted for the Seattle Police Chief and the City Light Director. In their letter, they say that Deputy Mayor Shefali Ranganathan had told HSD employees that, quote, there would be an inclusive process for the selection of the permanent director, end quote, but no such process has taken place. Durkan's response has been predictable. She sent a thank you for your input brush off letter in reply to Mosqueda and Gonzalez's letter. And in that letter, Durkin snottily says that Sawant has held only two meetings of her committee since last August without pointing out that council requirements during a budget year say that no other committees should meet while all nine city council members are working on the budget for those months, which often start mid-September and go through the end of November, which means that getting two meetings of her committee in that time from August through now is actually pretty good and very normal. Then Durkin had one of her underlings. She didn't even respond to Sawant. She had one of her underlings, legislative liaison Anthony Ariema, write a scolding, patronizing screed to council member Sawant, practically ordering her to do her job by holding a hearing for Johnson's nomination. Of course, that's not going to happen, according to Sawant. Now, if Sawant's resolution passes the council, then the mayor will have to conduct a formal search process. She'll be required to set up a search committee that includes human service department employees, nonprofit human service providers, people who have who are homeless or have experienced homelessness, and other clients of the human services department.
Yeah, and I talked last week about that evening hearing that Sawant held in Miller Park, mm-hmm. At which city employees and homeless service providers testified about Johnson's perceived shortcomings. And, Sawant chaired that meeting, but no other members of her committee showed up at that meeting. But
and I think partly that was because it was an evening meeting, and council yes. members are often reluctant to attend evening meetings.
Yes, but it is available on YouTube for anybody who wants to see it. And the city employees in particular who testified at that and who have subsequently joined in the letter expressing concerns about Johnson are doing so with a threat of retaliation.
It's courageous for them to stand up and do this.
That's the word I was looking for. Yeah, it's courageous for them to do it. And it shows that the opposition to Johnson is strong if they're willing to take that risk to their own livelihood.
And to show up to a city council meeting in their off hours. You know, you would have hoped that the city council members would have been willing to do, other city council members would have been willing to do that if employees of the Human Services Department were willing to do it.
Yes, exactly. And again, it underscores how hostile Durkin is to inclusive processes for major decisions, and the hiring decisions that she's had over the first year or so of her term have almost exclusively been that kind of backdoor room decision-making. And it's going to take a lot of watchdogging by the public in order for that to change.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk a little bit, too, about Durkin's other response to this, which is her solution to the affordable housing crisis. She announced this week yet another committee to help with the homelessness crisis, her Affordable Middle Income Housing Advisory Council. It's a planning committee of real estate developers meeting on the public dime to figure out ways to leverage public money to build workforce housing. Now,
a public-private partnership.
Yeah, a public-private partnership.
Those always work out.
Oh, yeah, they do. Now, workforce housing, just to remind folks, is defined by developers. And this is very important because there's different definitions of it. Developers define it as being for people who make between 80% to 120% of median income. Which in Seattle...
That's not where the severe shortage
no.
in affordable housing is.
In Seattle, that's housing for people who make between $80,500 to $120,750 a year. Or if you put that in terms of an hourly wage, it's $38.70 to $58 per hour. Those are not low-income people. Nonprofit housing advocates sometimes use a wider spread of 60% to 120% of median income, which in Seattle, again, is $60,370 per year to that $120,000 mark. So you'd have to make at least $29 per hour in a full-time job to afford one of those units. $29 per hour is still very far above what large employers pay for the minimum wage in Seattle, which is $16 per hour, or $33,280 per year in a full-time job.
by naming an advisory committee full of developers, at least Durkin is acknowledging who actually crafts most of the legislation in Seattle.
Yes. Now, members of the council include real estate developers like Vulcan Real Estate, who is one of the leaders in the council, along with former Governor Gary Locke, Spectrum Development Solutions, which has been involved in the Yesler Terrace takeover of the former public land at Yesler Terrace by private developers, Lake Union Partners, Blueprint Capital, Beacon Development Group, LMC Urban Evolution, some smaller developers like Barrientos Ryan and Guard Development, a few banks, a couple of real estate attorneys, and representatives of the Seattle Building Trades Union and the Master Builders Association of King and Snohomish County, to give the council an appearance that it's including some folks who represent labor. There's a member of the Yesler Community Collaborative, which has helped to gentrify Yesler Terrace and to turn over a lot of the public land that used to be part of Yesler Terrace to private developers, and to help drive out a lot of the poorest residents who used to live in Yesler Terrace. So that is Durkin's solution to the affordable housing crisis. Use the public resources to help developers network and get funding for more gentrification of the areas where the last few very poor people in the city of Seattle can actually find a place to live.
And I'm assuming that a lot of those folks have personally experienced homelessness, or have a really good firsthand view of what it's like to not be able to pay rent each month.
No, there's not a single member of the homeless community or of any human service provider that provides services to the homeless community or to people who are on the verge of experiencing homelessness. There's not a single one of those people on the council.
All right. Sounds like things are shaping up.
That's our conservative mayor who ran saying she really truly is a Democrat, but I don't believe her.
Yeah, and I'm also sensing that they're not going to recommend an employer hours tax.
No.
So also this week, we continue to view more people throwing in their hats into the ring for city council positions.
More election news.
Yeah.
Lisa Herbold running for re-election in District 1. That's West Seattle, Del Ridge, and South Park. And Jim Pugel running for Bagshaw's seat in District 7, which is downtown, Belltown, South Lake Union, Queen Anne, and Magnolia, my district.
And I would say that Lisa becomes the last of the incumbents to decide whether or not to run for incumbents in city council.
Has O'Brien announced that he was running?
I believe he has.
I don't think he has, actually.
I haven't seen it yet.
Formalized. Okay. I think he may be the last one.
Okay. Well,
that might be your secret pipeline that you have.
That we don't know about.
Yes, but we do have three open seats that we know of in the council races, and a lot of people jumping into those races. Mm-hmm. Bagshaw's retirement has drawn only one other major challenger so far, but there will be more, and more for all of these seats, so we'll keep you up to date.
Yeah. Now, excuse me, I just want to talk a little bit about Lisa Herbold. District 1, West Seattle, Del Ridge, and South Park. She really knows how to deliver stuff for her district, and she's done very, very well at that in the last few years. And so I think it's going to be a really high climb for anybody in that district to beat her for re-election.
Given that she was strongly opposed by the chamber and Shannon Braddock, who...
It's going to take a lot of money, but I don't know if
money,
it'll be successful.
I don't know that it will be either. Herbold won her 2015 race by only a few votes, mm-hmm. Literally, I think, 70 or something like that against Shannon Braddock. And Braddock, of course, went on to lose a race for state Senate this past year. But, Herbold, when I last talked to her a couple months ago... she was really pretty concerned about her reelection chances. Not to say she didn't think she could win, but she thought it would be a tough fight. And I think she's probably right in that, because her advocacy of the employee hours tax, she was the prime sponsor of the original legislation. That's going to draw a lot of opposition from deep-pocketed resources in the business community. And we'll see where those resources flow. It's not entirely clear from the folks who've announced for for District 1 already, which primarily include anti-homeless activists. They really don't have the look of the major kind of challengers that that Herbold is expected to draw.
Yeah.
But I think we'll see those folks emerge, and also for Shama Sawant's race as well. We're going to see a deep-pocketed challenger emerge pretty soon. These campaigns really need to be up and running by the end of this month or so in order to raise the kind of money it'll take to be competitive.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Herbold's history on the council, too. She served as Nick Licata's aide before she ran for election in District 1.
For 18 years.
Yeah, for 18 years. So Herbold, along with O'Brien and Bagshaw, really make up the institutional memory of the city council. And she stepped in along with O'Brien and Bagshaw to pick up different pieces to run the city council while its president, current president Bruce Harrell, kind of sits on his hands and fidgets, which is his typical modus operandi. Between the three of them, there's really been a lot of work done to kind of fill in for him. Bagshaw took on the budget this year, which is no picnic. Of course, it also allowed her to control the purse strings and drive the general direction of where money would be flowing in the budget. So there was no major changes
there. And Herbold did it the previous year.
Yeah. O'Brien took on the Sustainability and Transportation Committee in a year in which SDOT had been revealed to be a department in complete chaos. So he's had his hands full with that. And Herbold's done a little bit of everything else, really. She's often stepped in to provide background on issues, to mediate between other council members, or to just request more information from the mayor and the city on a specific issue, and more work by the mayor or the city to provide information to the city council and the public on things that they're doing. So she's been really valuable in the day-to-day running of the council. And she's a hard worker, unlike a certain council president I can think of at the moment. Although I want to say one thing in Bruce Harrell's favor. He's vice chair of Sawant's Human Services Committee, and his ineffectiveness on that committee has really allowed Sawant to take control of it, which I think is something to be said in his favor.
Yeah, well, he's retiring also, and that's also something to be said in his favor.
Yeah. Jim Pugel, on the other hand, he's the former police chief who took over the department as it was entering the police reform process. And he made some good strides in that direction, or began to make some strides in that direction, before former Mayor Ed Murray ousted him in favor of Harry Bailey, who had more support from the Seattle Police Officers Guild.
And was hostile to reform.
Yeah, and Jim Pugel had very little support from the Seattle Police Officers Guild, and they were quite hostile to him. Now, Pugel initiated the LEAD program, which helps keep people with drug convictions out of jail by diverting them into treatment programs instead, which has been continued by the department and is a very well-liked department. He also endorsed I-940, which is the police accountability legislation that passed in the Washington State Legislature last November, or was passed by voters last November after the legislature tried to amend it, and that didn't work out for them. He's gained endorsements from Lisa Dogard, who's the executive director of the Public Defenders Association and an advocate of police reform, and Dan Malone of the Downtown Emergency Services Center, which provides support to downtown's homelessness population, as well as Larry Gossett, the King County Council member.
And certainly Bagshaw has been missing in action for a lot of those downtown issues for several years. Pugel would also fill the void in former cops that was created when Tim Burgess retired.
Yes. Yeah, now he's the front runner, I think, in this race so far, and probably the best candidate to announce so far in District 7, which stretches, again, from downtown, north through Belltown, South Lake Union, up to Queen Anne and Magnolia, a district that tends to be pretty conservative and heavily influenced by business interests. And Pugel has said that he will be participating in the Democracy Vouchers program. So my guess is he's probably not getting a lot of the big business money behind him, at least not so far. We'll see if he continues with participating in that program. And it'll be interesting to see what his platform is when he develops it. It doesn't look like he has one quite yet, but he'll need to develop one fast, because people are going to start asking him questions pretty soon about more different things besides just police reform.
And having worked on city council campaigns, the number of different things that people ask you about that you never even thought about them in the process
are crazy.
The process of developing a platform is an ongoing one. Really, I hadn't thought about wastewater on houseboats and how it gets disposed and what the new Coast Guard regulations. What do I think of them? I don't know.
You know, yeah, because I don't know anything about that issue. Yeah.
Yes.
There's a lot to learn, and we'll see how quickly he how quick a study he is.
All right. Moving on to developments down in Olympia.
Oh, yeah. I just want to do a quick rundown of the bills in Olympia this week. There have been over 1,500 bills introduced into the state legislature this year. You may ask, why so many? There's a couple reasons. One is that the Democrats now control both houses, so there's an expectation that bills can pass easily. So everything's getting introduced. It's not a budget year also, so there's a lot more time for legislators to consider and pass other bills. And the legislature is finally out from under the McCleary cloud that's hovered over the legislature since 2012. So there, again, are a whole lot of hours freed up to work on other legislation. New this week was Senator Jamie Peterson's bill, Senate Bill 5784, to open up the state legislature's records to public scrutiny. For decades, the state legislature has exempted itself from Washington's 1972 voter-approved law that governs public records requests in the state of Washington. State, county, and municipal government offices have all had to adhere to that law and to make public emails, correspondence, calendars, reports, and investigations into misconduct by public employees. But the state legislature doesn't follow that rule, and that's become a problem, especially after recent news broke that accusations of sexual misconduct by state legislators had been hushed up. Last year, a Thurston County judge ruled that the state legislature was in violation of that public records law. So legislators hastily drafted and passed a law exempting the state legislature from the state's Public Records Act. They drafted and passed the law in 48 hours without a public hearing or any public input.
And there was a lot of public criticism.
There was a lot of criticism. Yeah. Now, Peterson's bill would open up state records, but only somewhat and not as much as the 1972 Public Records Act law would. So a much better bill would be one that repeals last year's terrible bill and declares that the state legislature will indeed comply with the 1972 law. That's a much better bill. So Peterson's bill is getting a hearing. It will probably go to a vote and may be passed by the state legislature, but the work of public advocates, public access advocates, is not over by far. So another bill is House Bill 1793, sponsored by Representative Joe Fitzgibbon of Seattle, which would allow cities and municipalities to use automated cameras to enforce traffic laws, particularly to track and mail tickets to drivers who block intersections and crosswalks, park in bus zones, and drive in transit-only lanes. Supporters of the bill say it will help disabled people and elderly people who have trouble navigating around cars that block crosswalks, and it would speed up bus routes as well as speed up traffic flow in general and cut down on congestion.
We're looking at you, downtown Seattle.
Yeah, seven other Democrats have signed on to that bill, including the chair of the House Transportation Committee. So there's a good chance it's going to get passed onto the House floor. There's also, I believe, a companion bill that's been introduced in the Senate, though I don't have the bill number for that. Another transportation-related bill is House Bill 1309 to levy a $100 fee on new studded tires. Studded tires rip up the roadways and cause an estimated $20 million to damage to street surfaces every year. Those repairs use up scarce transportation funding. Less than 2% of drivers in the state of Washington use studded tires because there are much better alternatives, like studless traction tires, chains, which you can take off when you reach bare pavement, and alternative traction devices. In fact, the Washington State Patrol has a list of alternative traction devices that are approved in the state of Washington, and four states ban studded tires outright: Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Illinois.
All of which have a lot more snow than Washington State.
Yeah, they don't have quite as many hills, though. But we could ban them outright. But, of course, this bill, instead of doing that, treats them as a source of transportation funding instead, which I think might be a mistake. We should probably just go for the ban outright.
Yeah, and it probably doesn't actually cover the cost of repairs that are necessitated.
No, it does not. It does not come close.
Yeah.
House Bill 1503 got a public hearing this week in the House Committee on Healthcare and Wellness. This is a bill that would create a public option healthcare plan on the state healthcare exchange, wahealthplanfinder.org. The bill would create three standardized plans, one on each tier, on the bronze tier, the silver tier, and the gold tier. All of the other plans offered on the exchange by private insurers would have to have exactly the same mix of benefits to make comparison easier for people shopping on the exchange. That would be an awesome step. In addition, the standardized plans would pay providers those same rates that Medicare, or they can't exceed what Medicare pays to providers. Lots of people spoke for and against the bill during its public hearing this week. Those who are most against it, of course, are doctors and hospitals who want to get paid more than the Medicare rates, insurance companies that want to offer plans with a different mix of benefits or fewer benefits, and business groups who oppose government intervention in the healthcare industry on principle because it limits the amount of profit you can make off of somebody's illness. There was a third group of people who testified. That's the folks who think House Bill 1503 doesn't go far enough. To quote Georgia Davenport, a Democrat and campaign director of Whole Washington, quote, "We need universal health care, not more for-profit tiered plans. 64% of voters in our state want government-funded universal health care. It's in the Washington State Democratic Party platform that we need a single-payer system on the state level and eventually federally," end quote. And I agree with her on that.
Yeah. And a reminder of the importance of offering benefits that are the same across the board, that are comparable to what is already being offered by the not-for-profit plans. The Trump administration has lifted the ban on the types of plans that have very high deductibles and cover nothing. So there's a lot of opportunity for insurance companies out there right now, as the law stands, to rip people off.
Yeah.
And they're fighting for the right to rip people off. That right should not be upheld at the state level.
Yeah. So, of course, the better bill would be there is a better bill that's been introduced into the Senate Bill 5222, sponsored by Bob Hasegawa, which would create a Washington Health Trust that would provide universal health care in Washington State. But it's languishing in the Senate Health and Long-Term Care Committee and hasn't been scheduled for a public hearing. The Democrats on that committee are the chair, Annette Cleveland. She's the 49th district in Vancouver. Vice chair, Emily Randall. She's the 26th district out on the lower Kitsap Peninsula. And member Steve Conway. He's the 29th district in Tacoma. Manka Dingra, the 45th district in Redmond and Kirkland, Dave Frocht, the 46th district in Northeast Seattle, Karen Kaiser, the 33rd district, that's Burien, Normandy Park, and SeaTac, and Kevin Van De Weeg, the 24th district out on the Olympic Peninsula. Those are the folks to call or email and ask them what they've done to advance Senate Bill 5222. Particularly those folks who are listening here in the city of Seattle, call Dave Frocht. He's your representative on this committee.
And in Northeast Seattle.
Yeah, yeah, Northeast Seattle. And you really need to put the heat on him.
And to his credit, Hasegawa has been an advocate for single-payer solutions for a long, long time. This is one of his major issues. And
yeah,
he deserves a lot of credit for continuing to push it in the state.
To push it every year. And again, that bill number is Senate Bill 5222. And then, of course, to wrap things up on the state legislature, there's the dwarf tossing bill. Senate Bill 5486 had its public hearing this week in the Senate Law and Justice Committee. Five people with dwarfism spoke at the hearing, providing some clarity on the bill, which is aimed specifically to end events held in bars and strip clubs where alcohol is served and people of full size are allowed to lift and throw people with dwarfism. It would not ban legitimate sporting events like wrestling contests. As for wrestling contests in bars, they tend to use the word midget to describe their events, which people with dwarfism view as a slur. So Senate Bill 5486 has advanced to executive session is now on the calendar for February 7th. So if Senate Bill 5486 can make it through, so can Senate Bill 5222.
Yeah, the dwarf tossing bill, mm-hmm, really it's a source of a lot of jokes for people, but it's pretty serious.
It's serious if you're
for people who are short. It's a very serious thing.
It is, things where they're made fun of, things that can risk a person's physical well-being like that, actually harm all people with dwarfism. So it is a serious bill. But again, if that bill can pass through and already get scheduled for a legislative on the executive session calendar, so can Senate Bill 5222.
And you have to wonder about a venue that, you know, encourages that in the first place, mm-hmm, you know, while you're giving your business to them.
Yeah, true.
So, all right. And then finally on local, the final plug has been pulled on an old supporter of all our work.
Yeah, for people who've been in Seattle for 20 plus years, you probably remember the Speakeasy Cafe in Belltown.
Oh, yes.
They were one of the very first internet cafes in Seattle, and very progressive, and did a lot of outstanding work in support of progressive causes. They were the cafe itself was put out of business by a fire in the late 90s, but the server, speakeasy.org, has continued. It had relatively few customers in recent years, and finally this past week they announced that they were going out of business, and the final people with Speakeasy internet service are left to find another service. But they did great work for a quarter century, and they will be missed.
Yeah.
Those were the good old days back during the WTO, leading up to that.
Yep.
Place mm-hmm. that we had many meetings at.
They held a lot of events there.
Lot of events, a lot of meetings, a lot of organizing meetings, and mm-hmm. People have a lot of good memories of it. Folks were there in that era.
All right. Moving on to national news, starting out with intelligence assessments and other fun from D.C.
Yeah.
You want to take the lead on this?
I will take the lead on that. The annual Worldwide Threat Assessment was released this week. That's the combined U.S. intelligence agencies getting together and listing what they think are the biggest threats to U.S. security around the world. And then they present the list to Congress and the White House. Dan Coats, the National Intelligence Director, and Gina Haspel, head of the CIA, both answered questions in Congress about the assessment. It differs from Trump's foreign policy in just about every major initiative that Trump has undertaken. First off, there's no mention of a wall on the southwest border. It does mention drug smuggling from Mexico, but that's very far down on the list of threats, and a wall is not mentioned as a viable solution at all in the threat assessment.
And undercutting the idea that a national emergency is
and that we need
border.
To spend north of $5 billion to build something that is not going to be a solution to any kind of crisis.
Let alone $25 billion, which is the overall cost.
Yeah. On Iran, the assessment asserts that Iran is complying with the 2015 nuclear agreement in defiance of Trump's Twitter spurts that continually contend that Iran is in violation. Trump calls the intelligence agencies naive in thinking this. But folks, let's really think about who's naive here, okay? On North Korea, the assessment shows how naive the president has been in claiming a victory after his meeting with Kim Jong-un. The assessment says that North Korea is continuing its pursuit of both a nuclear weapon and long-range missiles and is not likely to give up on that. On either of those two actions, because they see them as key to the survival of their regime. Meanwhile, a top U.S. negotiator, Stephen Biegun, this week has hinted that the Trump administration might not even require North Korea to release a full list of their nuclear assets. That's got to be the most naive thing I think I have ever heard.
And Trump is pursuing a second summit with Kim Jong-un because he's infatuated with him, apparently.
Yes, he thinks he's a great guy. Now, regarding the withdrawal of troops from Syria and Afghanistan, the assessment says that the Trump administration is far from conquering the Islamic State. ISIL is still pursuing attacks in Syria, as we've seen in the news, and has over a dozen active affiliates worldwide. And finally, Russia is near the top of the list of threats because of its growing cyber weapons capability. Now, you could see this report in one of two ways. Either it's a hard-headed look at reality, you know, a reality that completely contradicts Donald Trump's fantasy land.
Yeah, I would add to that list that it also identifies climate change as a major national security threat.
Which Trump thinks is non-existent, yeah.
Yes.
Or it's a concerted effort by all of the intelligence agencies to gang up on Donald Trump and make him look bad. Or, you know, there's a third possibility. It's
both.
Possible that both of those things are true simultaneously. Yeah, so take, for example, the Senate, controlled by Republicans, passed a bipartisan bill this week to condemn Trump's spur-of-the-moment decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria and Afghanistan. Democratic supporters that supported that bill were concerned that withdrawal of troops from Syria would condemn the Kurds to slaughter by the Turkish and Syrian governments, which is highly likely at this point. This vote also came on the heels of a report by the special investigator or the special inspector general for Afghan reconstruction that the Afghan government controls territory on which only 63% of its population lives. In terms of area, the Afghan government controls a little under 54% of the districts in the nation after having lost 7 districts in the past 3 months. 12% of the districts are under firm Taliban control, with the remaining 34% highly contested, with possibly the Taliban controlling some of them, but we're not sure. And also on Wednesday, both the House and Senate introduced a bill to end U.S. military assistance to Saudi Arabia in its aerial bombing campaign of Yemen. Again, something that Donald Trump supports because he's such a lover of dictators like the folks who run Saudi Arabia. Last year, this bill passed the Senate but died in the Republican-controlled House. But this year, it's highly likely to pass both houses. But will the president sign it? Probably not.
All right. Anything else on that?
No.
Nope.
All right. On to the current bill for the shutdown.
Yeah, the Congressional Budget Office came out this past week with this initial estimate of the financial cost of the first government shutdown that lasted 35 days and was resolved only a few days ago. We may be facing a second shutdown because the agreement that ended that government shutdown only reopened the government for 3 weeks while congressional negotiators try to find something that will appease the man-child in the White House. And that man-child has threatened a second government shutdown, which is something no people in Congress, including Republicans, want to see happen. Obviously, the polling for that first shutdown was disastrous for Republicans, and they're trying to avoid a repeat, and they're trying to explain to the said man-child that a second government shutdown would be a bad idea. Polling apparently for declaring a national emergency is similarly disastrous and is likely to fail a court challenge, which has all but been promised already. So Donald Trump doesn't really have many good options left for getting his precious wall, but that won't stop him from trying to get it. So the Congressional Budget Office estimated that first shutdown cost $11 billion to the economy in lost wages and productivity. Now, that includes both the wages lost to government workers and to businesses that rely on the patronage of government workers around areas like military bases, national forests, et cetera, where communities are heavily dependent on government employees and their paychecks for their business. And, of course, that lost business is not going to be reimbursed by the government, so they're just out of luck.
No, and even though I've seen some economists say that the economy will pick up and replace some of that lost business in the coming months, you can't recover all of it. There's going to be some net loss at the end, and that net loss is definitely going to be in the billions of dollars.
And the last major government shutdown, the initial estimate of the lost the cost to the economy kept creeping up over time as it became clear that the cost of the shutdown affected far more than government workers and government departments, that it has a ripple effect throughout the economy, and we're likely to see that later this year as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, moving on, the Great Midwest Ice Sheet.
Yes, I talked about the Greenland Ice Sheet last week, and then the week before I talked about the Antarctic Ice Sheet. Well, this week the polar vortex, which usually circles the Arctic and is held in place by a strong current, split into two. That's primarily because of climate change brought on by global warming weakened the strong current that holds the polar vortex in place, allowing it to sag down and cover most of the Midwest, parts of the South, and to head towards the East Coast. Now,
and allowing the people who look at every cold wave as proof that global warming doesn't exist to be particularly idiots.
Yeah. One part had dropped down over Europe. Europe is kind of used to that because the currents weakening around the polar vortex have been affecting Europe much more often than they affect the United States. But we got our dose of it This year, it brought record sub-zero temperatures to places from Minnesota in the north down to Illinois in the range of minus 50 to minus 60 degrees. And it brought snow and freezing temperatures as far south as Louisiana and Georgia, places where an inch or two of snow and freezing temperatures is a statewide emergency because those folks are just not prepared for that kind of cold weather.
Yeah, you literally have to wait for it to melt because they don't have snow plows. They don't have road salt.
No snow plows. People don't even have winter type coats to wear, much less hats and mittens and all the things you need, and snow boots and all the things you need to stay safe.
With the death toll from the cold wave in the Midwest, a lot of what we saw was people who were living on the streets being affected by it. And people in places like Chicago that have a large homelessness population, as do other major Midwest cities, Detroit, Minneapolis, et cetera, those folks had nowhere to go. There was a lot of emergency shelters opened, of course, but some people were simply left on their own to struggle with the cold.
Yeah, in addition, there's the economic impact. A lot of businesses were closed, schools were closed, hospitals struggled to accommodate people suffering from the cold, from frostbite and hypothermia. There were also a lot of roads closed, so truck traffic couldn't get through. There were we could see the Great Lakes starting to ice over, so there were a lot of ports that were affected by
this. Which almost never happens.
Yeah, almost never happens. The Great Lakes are so large that they never freeze over, right? Well, they did. This time around, there was a lot of freezing along the shores of the Great Lakes, and that directly impacted ship traffic. So there's the economic impact, and then there's going to be the melting impact as well, because when snow and ice melts, you get a lot of infrastructure damage and a lot of accidents and a lot of people get hurt. So that's going to be happening in the next few days as well. So chalk all this up to global warming and the idiot in the White House taking us out of the Paris Climate Accord and doing absolutely nothing, as well as the Republicans in Congress continually blocking any efforts to address our carbon emissions in the United States.
And unlike say major hurricanes, which have been hitting the U.S. coast over the last several years, and this is really a clear example of climate change impacting economics and having an economic cost to the economy of the United States. And we're starting to see estimates of what the cost of climate change is going to be. There was a recent estimate that it would cost the United States up to 10% of its GDP in coming years as the effects of global warming, starting with extreme weather events, take hold. And
that wipes out any kind of growth in the economy.
It also means that the traditional constituency for the Republican Party, that is the business community, has a vested interest in trying to address climate change. And the military, of course, has identified climate change as a major national security threat for years now.
So
you're going to see more and more pressure being put on the federal government to acknowledge that climate change exists and to take steps to ameliorate it at this point. Reversing it doesn't seem within reach at this point, but certainly taking steps to try and minimize.
Slow the rate of change.
Yeah, because every time a worst-case scenario comes out, it turns out to be an underestimate. The things are accelerating very rapidly, and the window for doing anything about that may have expired. We don't know, but certainly taking action now helps future generations cope with the fallout from it.
Mm-hmm. All right. And finally, on national developments this week with
Huawei.
Yes, I wasn't sure how to pronounce it.
Huawei. Yeah, the indictments against Huawei were issued on Monday. It's the largest telecom company in China, and there were indictments laid against its chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou, I believe is how you pronounce her name, the daughter of Huawei's founder. The charges have to do with stealing testing equipment from T-Mobile's laboratories in Bellevue and efforts to evade the sanctions on Iran. The Justice Department is trying to have Ms. Meng extradited from Canada Huawei has already been found guilty in a civil lawsuit brought by T-Mobile on the theft charges, which leaves just the sanctions charges as being new. Trump has already made comments that the indictment of Ms. Meng may put pressure on China during the current trade negotiations with China. This makes it look like he's using the Department of Justice, the law enforcement arm of the federal government, for his own political ends, which I think is very clear here, especially since Huawei is not the only company in the world and China not the only government in the world, which is violating sanctions that have been slapped on Iran primarily and almost entirely by the United States government and by no other nation in the world. The European Union is certainly doing their best, and their companies are doing their best to still trade with Iran in spite of the sanctions. So targeting Huawei is a very clearly a political move on the part of the Trump administration to try to put pressure on China during these trade negotiations. Now, in the meantime, the trade talks with China mostly involve a demand by the Trump administration that China cease requiring an American company to partner with and share technology with a Chinese company before it's allowed access to the Chinese market. The two sides, U.S. and China, have until March 2nd to come to an agreement, which is when Donald Trump's sanctions would kick in. The sanctions would raise tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese imported goods. With Trump failing at the wall negotiations and his shutdown of the federal government costing the U.S. economy $11 billion, he's under a lot of pressure to rack up a negotiating win, something more substantial, that is, than just a meaningless handshake with a dictator like what he's gotten from his meetings with Kim Jong-un. So he's doing his best to try to make China cry mercy, you know, please let us have access to your market. But I don't know that the Chinese are going to be responding the way he wants them to.
Yes, and the way they're more likely to respond is by imposing their own retaliatory tariffs the beginning of March.
Which will have a major effect.
In an election year the beginning of the presidential campaign, certainly, on states in particular that supported Trump in the 2016 election, the agricultural sector, manufacturing in the Midwest, et cetera, the Chinese sanctions are very specifically aimed at Trump and his supporters because, frankly, that seems to be the only people that Trump listens to, and the Chinese are savvy enough to understand this. So it will cost the U.S. economy at least as much as the sanctions the U.S. sanctions will cost the Chinese economy, which is also in trouble. And any kind of fallback in the Chinese economy, which is pretty fragile at this point, will have repercussions around the world, including in the U.S. economy. So there's a lot of risk here to the economic well-being as the year goes on. And it's all at the feet of Donald Trump.
And clearly, Trump doesn't understand that he's the main, like in other crises we've talked about in recent weeks on the show, that he's the main creator of the crisis, just as he was the creator of the crisis with the federal government shutdown, with the wall negotiations, with immigration detentions, so on and so on and so on. Again, he's the main creator of the crisis with these trade talks and of the economic fallout because of his trade policies.
Yes. Main character in our own personal Grimm's fairy tale. All right. And speaking of which, Trump administration pulling out of the INF this week?
Yeah, the Intermediate Ballistic Missile Treaty with the Soviet Union in 1984 was seen as a great breakthrough in disarmament negotiations, and Russia and, to a lesser extent, the United States abolished some of those missiles as a result of that treaty. But Russia in recent years has been seen by the international community as being in violation of that treaty. So the Trump administration announced this week that it would withdraw from the treaty, which basically is a huge gift to Vladimir Putin. Just in time for Valentine's Day.
And I noticed that Putin verified almost immediately that he was also withdrawing from the treaty, which I think raises the question of if this is this what he and Trump have been discussing at all their little private secret meetings.
It certainly is, and we'll get to that in a second. But the logic of the Trump administration basically is, well, we might as well withdraw from the treaty because they weren't following it. This essentially is they weren't following the law. So we abolished the law. Really doesn't work.
Yeah, it contradicts what they're doing with Iran. They claim that Iran is not following the treaty that we signed with them. So instead of withdrawing from that treaty, Trump slapped sanctions on Iran. Why not slap sanctions on Russia?
Yeah, Iran really is the outlier in Trump's love affair with dictatorial governments. It's really kind of odd why he doesn't.
Well, they're an enemy of
them.
Saudi Arabia, that's why.
Well, that's true. When dictator is pitted against dictator, you got to pick one, or not.
That's true. So one of the things that I noticed, too, is that John Bolton appears to be at the heart of a lot of these decisions to withdraw from treaties. He was,
and he is a notorious hawk on Iran.
Yeah, he was instrumental in the Bush administration withdrawing from the anti-ballistic missile treaty with Russia in 2002. And he hates these international agreements. He doesn't believe in getting along with other nations or cooperating with other nations on any kinds of projects because he thinks that hampers the United States' rightful place as the ruler of the world. And in this case, he is front and center. And pushed very hard for the abolishment of this intermediate range nuclear forces treaty, which has been kind of the keystone to security in Europe for decades.
Yeah, this is really an alarming move for our allies in Europe, who of course Trump doesn't care about, because they would literally have seconds to respond to an attack from Russia, and Russia is clearly aggressive in this era. They see Russia as a serious threat to their security and well-being, and the United States isn't helping right now. They seem to be on Russia's side in that conflict.
Yeah, and I think we tend to forget the history of the INF Treaty too. Over 2,500 missiles have been decommissioned because of it. That, you know, can we not agree that fewer nuclear weapons is a good that we need to strive for? You know, apparently not when it comes to someone as insane as Donald Trump
and John Bolton.
Yeah, and John Bolton. No, the more nuclear weapons, the better in their minds. And well, and that's, you got to label that what that is. That's just outright crazy.
Related to that, this week there was also news came out about the production beginning at Pantex of the new W-76-2 nuclear warheads that are the lower yield 5 to 7 megaton. Nuclear bombs.
Yeah, supposedly to allow you to destroy another nation's population without affecting your own, which I think is absolutely crazy.
And ups the chances of nuclear weapons being used dramatically by those going into production and being used. And they will be mounted on Trident subs like we have here 20 miles from where we're sitting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Dr. Strangelove kind of material. It's really reckless.
So it's time, past time, for another anti-nuke movement.
Yep.
To gear up and get cracking.
And people may remember who were around in those days. The anti-nuclear movement in the 80s was a direct response to Ronald Reagan's saber rattling and really forced him into the kind of treaties that Trump withdrew from this week.
Yeah.
It was responsible for a lot of the deals.
Pains me to see us having to start it all over again. But
exactly,
the Tuesday clock is still at 2 minutes, before midnight.
Yeah.
So things have not changed. Things have gotten worse in the last, 10 years.
Yeah.
And certainly the last two.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. On that happy note, events.
Yeah. On next coming Wednesday from 6 to 8 o'clock. Not This Time is having a community sit-down with elected leaders and law enforcement leaders regarding implementation of I-940, which Maria mentioned earlier in the show. That was the initiative that passed last year on use of force in police departments and law enforcement agencies. This will be a chance to ask questions about changes in training for law enforcement officers and so forth. That will be held at the Seattle Vocational Institute, 2120 South Jackson Street in Seattle. And then a week from Tuesday, February 12th, is when your ballots are due for the education levy. So fill your ballots out and mail them in. And you don't require a postage stamp for them now, so get them in the mail.
And just a little reminder, on Monday, Shalma Sawant will be announcing her resolution to the mayor to open up the search process for the Human Services Department Director at the Seattle City Council. So if you want to be in the audience there when that is introduced, then show up for the City Council meeting on Monday.
2 o'clock, City Hall. Be there.
Yep.
All right.